Hi everyone, Ed here. GeoMob has been growing, and with it the cost to keep the operation running. So as we discussed earlier this year, we're going to start experimenting with relevant ads here on the podcast. I don't think we could get more relevant than our first advertiser, B-Maps, powered by HiveMapper. So you may recall HiveMapper CEO Ariel was a guest here on the podcast back in episode 179. Here's the deal. Your map is only as good as its data. Without fresh data, a map isn't smart. It's stale. B-Maps is here to help. Since 2023, they've mapped 350 million kilometers of roads with dash cams that were designed for mapping. B-Maps offers simple APIs to access all that imagery, or just the map features you care about. With B-Maps, you can see roads as they exist today without collecting your own data or compromising on quality. Three of the top 10 global map makers use B-Maps to keep their maps fresh. Try it for yourself today, and you'll get 50% off API credits through December 31st with promo code GEOMOB. Just visit bmaps.com/geomob. That's BEEmaps.com/geomob. A big thank you to BMaps for sponsoring the show. Now on to the episode. Welcome to the GeoMob podcast, where we discuss geo innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
Hello, and welcome back to another GeoMob podcast. Today, we are talking about the application of deep learning to satellite imagery, and as importantly, the community that is growing up in that area. With me to discuss all of this is Dr. Robin Cole. Robin, welcome to the podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
So I guess the usual question that comes on every podcast there is, what's your background in Earth observation?
Sure. So I actually come from a physical sciences background. I did a PhD in optical physics, which was in a lab doing spectroscopy. I did various jobs in R&D, went into medical physics for a while. And when I was working in medical physics, I was next to the building where they make satellites for Surrey Satellites. I decided medical physics wasn't for me, but satellites looked really interesting. I had a background in optical already, so I applied for an optical systems engineer role there. And that was my first role inside this sector. I stayed there for about a bit under 2 years, and my role kind of changed. It was engineering, more sort of project management, and then segueing into the software side. I was really interested into the Python language at the time. I had a real passion for doing Python projects on the side, and then that skill was required for the processing of the imagery as well. So that's really when I first got stuck into remote sensing and deep learning.
Yeah, cool. That's quite fortuitous that you were next to the Surrey Satellites building, but also there's a exactly. There's also a whole conversation about transferable skills there. I mean, for a long time, I've said that physics and maths is a really, really strong background to have. Do you have any sort of views on that?
Oh, 100%. So, I mean, this point in my life was quite an interesting time. I mentioned I went from research and I'm now into sort of the programming side of things, but there was a few years, maybe 3 or 4 years, when I didn't really know what to do with myself, if I'm being totally honest. I knew that, you know, academia was not for me. I didn't see myself, you know, being a professor, that kind of thing. Industry, much more appealing, but to be a professional physicist in industry, there's not that many roles in the UK. I did one at Sharp Labs where I was like making systems to use lasers, for example, but there's not really that many roles. So I was kind of looking to get from that researchy side into something more on the industry side. I went into medical physics thinking that would be a really nice combination of kind of research and kind of practical work. Tended to be more on the practical side and not enough on the research side for me, so I felt that wasn't for me. But I saw this potential in the remote sensing domain. There's lots of engineering happening there, lots of innovation happening on how you process the data. There's both government, there's commercial side. This is a really interesting sector to be in, and I pretty quickly had a feeling that I had finally arrived at the right place.
That's excellent. Yeah, it was really, I must admit, that sort of point, I've had a couple of points in my career similar to that, where you're sort of wondering, like, is this quite the right thing? And then you find something and it's like, oh yeah, this is definitely what I want to do. And it's a really good feeling. Yeah. So if anyone's out there who's listening, who's not sure what they want to do with their career, definitely, you know, just keep casting the net and you'll find something, I'm sure.
Yeah.
With this episode, what we want to talk about is deep learning. Deep learning is a very specific part of the whole AI family. AI is obviously very big at the moment in a more general sense. But could you maybe talk a little bit about what deep learning is in the context of Earth observation, and sort of when deep learning really grabbed your attention, because it's, you know, you're known for deep learning now, really.
Right, good to know. I mean, deep learning uses neural networks, and neural networks are not a new idea. They've been around since the 50s, and, you know, there's been lots of work on them, but they didn't really have, all the ingredients weren't there. This changed in 2012. There was this competition, it's very well known in the computer vision competition, using this ImageNet data set, which is basically like classifying what's in the image, cats and dogs. And, you know, progress had been steady for years and years. And in 2012, there was a step change. A team led by Jeffrey Hinton came along, and they used deep neural networks to tackle this classification problem. And they improved on the benchmark by a significant amount. And this was kind of like a lightning bolt to the computer vision community. Wow, this technology, it can deliver, right? And it's a really exciting time. As I say, this was in 2012. This is actually before I got into remote sensing domain. I was still working in the medical domain at the time, but there's lots of interest in that domain, of course, with computer vision and neural networks. Lots of the routine work is, can we look at an X-ray and find, a tumor, something like that? And, of course, computer vision enables you to potentially automate a lot of that and scale it out, for example. So I've been following it along. As I mentioned, I was in medical physics and I saw this satellite opportunity. So I segued over there. I was doing some sort of more general image processing. It was all around, calibration of optical instruments, basically. But we had this task. We had a large catalog of images captured by the satellites, and they weren't indexed. They were just sitting there on literally piles of CDs and DVDs. And the business wanted to make these accessible so that people, in the sales side could access that and show potential customers, what we've captured in the past. So, I was given this opportunity. It was literally like 2 days, do a proof of concept, try and index all this imagery using, a deep learning approach. And at this time, everything was still very fresh. I remember using like a TensorFlow script. I was running it on my MacBook because I didn't have a GPU at that time. And it literally made the thing red hot and it ran for several hours. But I was able to train a classifier where you would like tag this image is, vegetation or urban, that kind of thing. And this is like revolutionary. Nobody had ever seen this being done. And so we were able to like index this data, put it in a more useful format and, expose that to the business team. And that was a really useful thing for them. But it also showed the potential was there. And actually, it was something that an engineer could get stuck into without needing to be too much of a specialist.
Right. So just to be clear then, what you were doing was effectively indexing those images, but without a human actually having to open up the image and see what's in there. So
that's right.
Yeah. I definitely see the potential for that sort of thing. So is that sort of where deep learning is still very important? Because obviously we have an absolute sea of data coming down from satellites now and from other sensors and from modeling and all sorts of places. Is indexing still a really important component, or is it moved more broadly? Or so what's the state of affairs in deep learning?
I think without a doubt, the volume of imagery requires that we have some automated means for making sense of it. You can tag an image with where it was captured and the time, etc. But in the past, you couldn't say what was in the image. So if you were searching for a picture of an airstrip, for example, that would be some kind of geospatial query. Now you can have a model that could maybe tag, this image contains an airstrip and a port, something like that. So we have these new capabilities. And like I said, I think the volume of imagery just requires that we need to be able to do this. Obviously, what I was talking about was over 10 years ago now, this classification approach, The ImageNet making that possible. Obviously, it's a very rapidly evolving area. There's new capabilities coming along all the time. And there's a bit of a time delay. A new technology comes along, it's published. It takes a few years for that to really get adopted by, mainstream users, I think. And I think we're just at that point now where those kind of early technologies are becoming mainstream, and you've got platforms like ArcGIS where they can actually use deep learning models and tag your imagery, and that's becoming mainstream now, I think. So there's always a bit of a pipeline. Something new comes along, it gets kind of battle tested, the R&D side, and then if it's commercially useful, it makes it through into the everyday software experience.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because at the moment, there's a lot of conversation around the web browser Firefox embedding some AI into its offering, and I guess, you know, I mean, the more that these deep learning techniques get developed and the models are there, whether it's a text-based thing or whether it's an image-based thing or whatever, then software are going to start to just incorporate that. And I guess users won't necessarily know or care about the sort of technology that's gone into creating those models. It's more about, can the user get the information out of the huge data lake that they have before them? So,
and I think that's a really interesting topic in itself. Like, we're seeing this kind of change in just what does software engineering even mean. In the past, it was all rules based and you could unit test everything, and now there's a model in there, and you know, it's integral to the performance of the software. Everything is shifting and expectations are changing. We're getting new capabilities. It's a very exciting time to be in this sector. I think people that are purely focused on software are saying it's just a very exciting time to be a software engineer in general, but specifically in the remote sensing domain, it's all coming together.
Yeah, definitely. So are there sort of set methods and libraries and things that get implemented for geospatial and earth observation deep learning? You've sort of intimated that there's a lot of development going on. Is the whole sector in flux and that there's no set standard way of doing things at the moment? You know, what's the exciting thing to be looking at?
Yeah, I mean, there was a few years, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, where there was this ongoing conversation, do we use PyTorch, do we use TensorFlow and Keras? That kind of argument seems to have been settled now. Most people are using PyTorch, and we're seeing a standardization around that language and framework, you know, for building systems. There are others, like, I think, like DeepMind have their own, you know, language for training models, for example. Right. But generally, most people are using Python. Most people are using PyTorch. Not to say everybody is, and there's some sort of compatibility there as well. Moving on to remote sensing and computer vision. In the computer vision area, there's a few big libraries like Torch Vision, and then there's another one called OpenMMLab, which comes from another set of researchers. Focusing specifically on remote sensing, there's two that I think really stand out for me. One is Raster Vision, and the other is Torch Geo. They accomplish many of the similar things, but they're basically remote sensing specific frameworks, which allow you to do everything from, you know, creating training data sets to some extent, and then training models on those, and even then using those models in a production-like setting. As I mentioned, there's been a continual evolution in this field, and there's always new libraries coming along. A couple of notable ones recently have been addressing the challenge of training foundational models, which are models trained on vast quantities of data. And we've seen code bases from, for example, the Clay Foundation, IBM and others, which are specifically focused on the training of those kinds of models. And there is overlap between all these different frameworks as well. But state of play is that I think the foundations are now pretty solid and there's still lots of innovation happening where it's required.
Okay, cool. I've heard of Raster Vision. I've not heard of Torch Geo. You called them frameworks. Do they basically guide you through the process? So if I was, I wanted to create a model that found, I'm trying to think of something, palm trees in an image, high resolution image or something. Would I go to one of these frameworks with my big image stack and say, okay, I'm going to extract some training data and then just follow the steps through one of these frameworks? Is that effectively how it would go?
Yeah, they both would allow you to bring in that data set. There's some requirements there about how you need to pre-process that. For example, if you want to annotate it, they don't provide annotation features, but there are other tools like that. But once you've annotated your data and it's in one of the sort of standardized formats, then they can take it. They provide all the code that you would need to then use that in training a model, evaluate that model. And I think with Raster Vision, it even provides the code to then deploy that into a live system. So they provide all of the necessary code, the abstractions, the instructions on how to do things. When I'm talking about TorchGeo, they also provide many data sets because there's hundreds of data sets out there and they've actually provided the code. So you don't need to know anything about them to use them. You can just like import data set, train model, essentially.
Okay. And are there any specifics that a user needs in terms of hardware? I mean, does it have to be can you do it on a decent laptop or does it have to be cloud-based or?
I mean, it depends on your laptop, of course. And for example, I've got a Mac. It's a pretty new one. And the newest Macs even have, I think, like a specialized GPU in there. And I think some libraries can take advantage of that. For the most part, I actually work on cloud machines. I use this platform called Lightning AI, which comes from the creators of PyTorch Lightning. But it's basically a bit similar to Colab. I think it's more production-ready environment. But basically, you're in a browser, you're in an IDE, and if you want to go from a CPU to a GPU, GPUs generally cost you more money. So you kind of use them sparingly, basically. You can just toggle between them. And then when you're ready to train your model, that's when you switch to the GPU and, you know, begin that process.
Okay. And so again, I mean, I'm a few years out of date in terms of knowing anything about this area, but I remember being sat in a conference and there was big discussion around training data sets. So in particular, trying to have generalized training data, I think, for Sentinel-2 and similarly for Sentinel-1. I'm sure it's the same for lots of other different types of satellite data as well. Is getting hold of training data still a big thing, or have big advances been made in creating sort of general training data sets?
So I think there's two parts to that. Accessing data, I think, has become easier in the last couple of years. We have things like STAC, which is like a standardized way of accessing data. And you've got things like the Planetary Computer and Google Earth Engine, which provide these big catalogs of data. So first of all, getting the raw data has become easier more recently, and there's like standardized frameworks around accessing that, of course. And then the other side is, well, annotating the data. In the past, before we had foundational models, you would always go off and start annotating the largest data set you had the budget for. And generally you needed, it depends on the complexity of the task you're working on, but it's a significant undertaking, you know. We're moving to a situation now where you've got these foundational models, which basically have already been pre-trained on vast amounts of data, and they hopefully mean you need less annotated data to get a good model. So I think the situation is evolving. Generally, you're probably still going to need to annotate some amount of data, but probably less than it was in the past. It's focusing on specifics, constellations like Sentinel-2. There are large unannotated data sets out there. People pre-train on those, and then they just need to bring a smaller annotated data set to fine-tune for specific tasks like tree segmentation, I think you mentioned before. So the situation is definitely evolving.
Okay. We'll come on to talk about some of your community growth and community work in a minute, but I was listening back to some of the podcasts that you've released as part of that. And there were two that really stood out for me, actually. One was around creating synthetic data, which I found really interesting in terms of just being able to take a model and create data that you can then do actual analytics on as well, even though that data doesn't exist. And the other one was around generating field boundaries. And I know this is something that is of quite a lot of interest to non-geo people, like people who actually have jobs where they need to go out and understand the site and that type of thing. And I started following some of the links in particular around the field boundary one. And it's quite amazing, actually, what can be done, given that there's so much difference in terms of what one field is compared to another field, depending on where you are, not just in the country, but sort of in the local area.
Yeah.
So it's very impressive, I think, what these models can actually do in terms of feature recognition.
That's right. I mean, as we just were talking about in the past, you'd always be prepared to start training your own model to do the thing you wanted. But we're getting to the point, and I can talk a bit more about the field boundaries, where you probably will only need a few examples of the thing that actually you want to achieve in order to have a solution that can do that. So coming to the field boundaries, that was quite interesting. And that was about using Segment Anything from Meta, which is a large kind of foundational model that's is trained on very diverse data sets. I'm not sure if there's actually any remote sensing data in there, but it allows you to, you know, get predictions without training on remote sensing data. And so what that piece of work showed that is, even without training a model, just by understanding how to pre-process the data, you can get good results on remote sensing data. Yeah. And I think that was a really nice thing, because actually he did go through the process of fine-tuning a model, and it actually didn't get him a better solution than actually just working on the pre-processing. Remote sensing data, I mean, it's kind of unique in the sense we see the world, you know, from a different perspective, and we might be using multispectral and strange resolutions and things like that. But these models that are trained on more general data sets can still be useful when applied to remote sensing data, if you know some of the extra things you might need to do. So in that particular example, he combines a time series of data into like an HSV color space. And then that image was just processed with Segment Anything and was giving useful results.
Yeah, it's amazing. Really is amazing what can be done. So I guess no discussion of AI would be complete without discussing large language models. Is there anything that's being done around that in geospatial? Are they
being absolutely embedded?
Yeah,
I gave a talk on this topic at a Lightning meetup a couple of months ago, but I think the context here is how do we work with geospatial data? And I've only been doing this for a few years, but my impression is it hasn't really changed too much over the last couple of decades. There's some sort of catalog interface and you write some kind of SQL-like query, maybe with a location and a time, and you get a bunch of results. But I think LLMs will enable us to access this data archive in a completely different and much more natural way. You know, if you go to something like ChatGPT, you just talk to it essentially and you have a conversation. And I think we're going to see those kind of interfaces for these archives of data and also the analytics that's produced on top of that. And I think that's just the beginning as well, because if you look at what's going on in the LLM space, there's all this interest around agents. And agents are kind of, they're more than a chatbot, but you can give them skills and tasks and they can go off and accomplish things. So the future what workflow might be like, I want to find all the palm trees over this island. And in the background, it knows it needs to do some query and choose the right model and then filter the results based on some criteria and then present them back to you. And it should be able to do all of those things. So I think that's where things are heading. And it's very exciting for opening up, you know, the data and the information that's there to a much wider audience.
Wow. Okay. That whole, the notion of being able to, in a very broad humanistic way, just say, this is my problem and I want the answer. And then, well, just thinking about everything that needs to happen on the infrastructure side in order to get the processing to happen, but also the model needs to understand what it is that you're looking for. That's so powerful. That could totally transform the way that we handle data. So are there specific organizations, research institutes that are looking into these things at the moment?
Yeah, there's multiple efforts, and I'm sure every large company with, you know, enough data is looking at their own ways of doing it as well. It's a very new area, and I think it's as much as learning how people are going to interact with these systems as what's possible, because so much is possible. We need to understand what the workflows look like that people want to use. So I think there'll be a bit of a process of finding out what's actually useful. But at the same time, the capabilities will keep on evolving. So I think it's a very exciting time. And I just hope that the net result is that more people can access this data and solve their problems.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, having a model that is actually useful and answers people's problems, I think will be a huge step forward in the sense that you've just mentioned. Although I guess at some point someone will also invent a model that allows you to create a cat that has the same bands as a Landsat image or something.
That's a good idea. I think people are doing something with your name and Landsat at the moment. I'm not sure if it uses a model.
Oh, yes, yeah.
But I think any of these things, they might sound a bit like trivial, but if they get somebody interested in the domain, then they're actually doing something useful for the community.
Yeah, that's true. Talking of community, you've built an entire community in this area. So you have over 6,000 members on a LinkedIn group linked to deep learning and Earth observation. You also do your own podcast. You've got a YouTube channel. There's a website, a GitHub repo. I'm probably missing something as well, because there seemed to be an awful lot around that community. Can you tell us a little bit about the driver behind that and what it's been like for you seeing it grow? Because it's amazing just how quickly it's grown.
Yeah, it was never like an objective of mine to create these things, but it just kind of happened by chance. It started with this GitHub repository that was just basically indexing all this useful material that I had found useful to me when I was doing research into deep learning on satellite imagery, and that now is the most starred repository in the sort of remote sensing category. And for a little while I was kind of motivated to beat GDAL and get more stars, so I was like, I'll start promoting this on LinkedIn and see if I can get the most stars, and you know, I did.
But congratulations.
I mean, there was never really an objective to do that. It was just like something kind of fun to do.
Yeah.
And so I saw there's a lot of interest in the topic. And I noticed that when I posted on this topic, both the GitHub itself, but also just generally remote sensing and deep learning, you get lots of engagement on a platform like LinkedIn, lots of people interested in that area. And this then leads to more followers for you and then people coming back and asking you questions. And there's a bit of a feedback loop. And at some point, you're just kind of in the process of putting out more and getting more kind of engagement. But I wanted to make it a bit more manageable, because, you know, an endless stream of tweets or LinkedIn posts isn't necessarily very consumable. So I thought, well, I'll create a group and that'll then aggregate all this information in one place. That's how the LinkedIn group, and there's also a Twitter one as well. The podcast is kind of fun because I was having occasional conversations with domain experts around various technical topics. And the first guest on my podcast, Mikolaj Chorowski, he also then ended up becoming kind of helping me to build the podcast. So we were just having a Zoom call one day about like this product, this tool had been developing for simulating clouds. And we're like, this is a really cool conversation. And it occurred to me that other people might also benefit from hearing that conversation. So I can't remember exactly how we went about it, but we decided we'd record it and put it up as a YouTube. And I could take a kind of minimalist approach to making my podcast. I just have a Zoom call, I just record it, and that's pretty much the extent that I've done so far to create these things. But to get something that's a bit more, you know, polished and ready for YouTube, you have to do a bit of editing, put an intro screen. That's where Mikolaj was able to help out because he has capabilities with Photoshop and things like that. So he helped me to create that first episode, and we put it out. I just enjoyed it. I like chatting to people, and it kind of gives me an excuse, if you like, to have these really in-depth conversations with people and then put it out there. And it's steadily growing. And I think that all these different mediums, they kind of have the strengths and weaknesses. You know, LinkedIn, different from YouTube, of course. If you want to make a visual presentation, you need, you know, something like the video. If you just want to have audio, then that's a different kind of way you can focus. So each of these platforms, they kind of allow you to expose information in a slightly different way. I enjoy making the podcasts and the videos. And then I also was getting feedback that, oh, it'd be great if you'd have a newsletter, because then you could like curate the best of what you see. And I was like, fine, okay. And I was between jobs for, and had a few months where I had a bit of time. So I was like, okay, I'll start the newsletter and I'll see, you know, if there's interest in that. And that's really taken off. It has over 10,000 subscribers now, which really exceeded all my expectations. And so all these things just kind of have a momentum of their own at some point. You just keep on doing them. I think what my objectives are is to try and make this thing bigger than just myself. And I think that's when it will become a real community, because you can have an influencer that does all this stuff and people follow them. But if one day they just decide they're not going to do it anymore, that will, you know, disappear, won't it? What you really want to get to is some sort of self-sustaining community, which is bigger than just the one person that started it. And I found that, for example, having Mikolaj assist me with the podcast greatly gave me more enthusiasm for the task, and we produced lots of great content through that. So I think bringing in more contributors is definitely critical to making more, you know, a successful community. And then long term, there's other tasks, like if once you've got a community, you have to manage it. So we created like a Discord server, and things happen, like it needs a bit of management. You get like spam on there, somebody has to go in and clean it up, somebody has to do updates to the server and things like that. So it does start to take on a bit of time as well. But I think the key is to get, you know, more contributors and really good quality contributors, and then at some point it should become self-sustaining.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, I really encourage people to go and check it out and contribute if they can, and to contact you if they're interested. So what sort of, when you talk about contributors, what sort of contributions are you looking for? Are you looking for in-depth technical how-to type of things? Are you looking for just pulling together news from around the world about what's happening?
It could be a combination of those things. So, you know, for the newsletter, for example, I need to find interesting material. Sometimes people send me a DM. We just published this paper. We think it'd be interesting. That's useful. That helps me to find the right content. As I mentioned, actually, like managing something like a chat server, there's, you know, a bit of legwork. Other people have particular skills. Like I mentioned, Mikolaj had the skill in editing the videos, which is something I didn't have, which enabled those to be a higher quality and, you know, reach more people. So, you know, people come with their own skill sets and personal passions. That really helps to grow, you know, the content that organization can produce. And, you know, I'm always looking for what's next. You know, I'm this kind of personality that always wants to be growing things, otherwise they get a bit stale. So I've got some ambitions for this community. I would like to do, for a while I've had this idea about creating a course, because there's not really a course out there for how do you do, you know, deep learning on satellite imagery. There's a few like on YouTube and other places and stuff, but I thought it'd be great to have like a community effort and make a course. I tried this. I got lots of interest from various academics, but, you know, it's kind of a big project to bring together. But that's something I would like to see happen at some point. And I've also had this idea about running like online conferences. because I've got a bit of an issue with the way conferences are run at the moment. They're always in a specific country and you've got to fly there. And if you can't fly there, you can't participate. It's just a bit bonkers to me that conferences, they should be at least partially online, but that would open up the access and I think would just make them much more interesting as well. And that's something I would like to do with this community. Maybe like, you know, a half-day event focused on some specific part of this domain and, you know, getting... just doing something a bit different. I've participated in some other people's online conferences and found them really inspiring. So I'd like to do something like that as well. But the challenge is always finding the time. The more ambition you have, the more time it requires.
Yes, exactly. No, I totally agree with you though on the conferences. I think, having to go to a physical location is very restrictive and not particularly environmentally sensitive either these days. Yeah. So... I guess as well, what you're really looking for in the community is for people to sort of, they might not be able to show their potential in their day job, but if they become part of a community as well, they can really, well, hopefully they would start to shine, you know, because I've seen communities around Linux and Python, bits of software and things where you get sort of those leaders that didn't initialize the community, but they start to become so involved and so key that, you know, they really do push forward that community. I guess you're looking for that sort of person as well as just sort of your standard contributors as well.
Absolutely. I mean, many of these sort of inquiries I get from people that are trying to get into this area, they may be working in some other, you know, area of imagery, or, you know, people new in their career and they know they want to sort of raise their profile and, you know, network, that kind of thing. By getting involved in these kind of community efforts and also open source software as well, you can actually raise your profile, network, develop new skills, find new passions. So I think there's lots of return on investment once you decide to put your energies into that kind of task.
Yeah, no, definitely. So can you just quickly maybe tell us about some of the most interesting applications of deep learning for Earth observation that you've come across? I'm sure you must have come across loads.
Yeah, the list is endless. I mean, many of them start to get quite similar, like we'll detect a new building or a new road, something like that. But there's some really interesting areas. I'm particularly passionate about the area of ecology and wildlife monitoring, for example. And there's been some really interesting data sets and, you know, solutions built how to monitor wildlife and biodiversity. One of the more interesting data sets I've seen combined both satellite imagery and citizen science data. So they were going out with phones and snapping images and taking literally audio recordings of the sound of a forest to understand the biodiversity there. And then creating a model based on those two sort of data sources to understand the biodiversity in an area. And that was really interesting to me, both, you know, technically, how do you combine different data sources, but also how are you going to initiate a project like that? Because you have to bring in, well, satellite companies, you have to bring in groups of people on the ground who are going to capture this, and then also experts to bring it all together. And like I say, I've got a bit of a passion for those kind of biodiversity and ecology kind of applications. So I really like that. There's lots of progress happening in the area of generative AI. That's really exciting because, as I mentioned earlier on in the show, one of the big challenges of deep learning is you always need some annotated data. Sometimes that's impossible to get. You may be looking for something like a whale that you've only got 5 pictures of, and it's impossible to get more of those. I think tools like generative AI are going to allow us to create the data sets we need to get useful models, and that particular area is experiencing rapid growth at the moment. That's something I'm very excited about because it should enable us to lower the barrier of entry, come with fewer examples, and get useful solutions.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. The ecology thing is interesting as well. I was talking to someone the other day, and they're really into dragonflies, and they were saying what they would love is to be able to have an app on their phone so that they could see like a pond environment in the same way that a dragonfly would. And apparently dragonflies see in a specific range of wavelengths of light, and also they see, let me get this right, I think they see a slowed down version of what the human sight see. Anyway, they were talking about it, and I was thinking at the time, I have no idea how you would go about doing this, but maybe it's the sort of thing that you could create models for that would then generate
experience life as a dragonfly.
Yes, exactly. It seemed a very odd thing to do, but who knows. So I'm conscious that we need to wrap up, but how can people find you and how can they find your community as well and get involved in that?
Yeah, I've tried to make that as easy as possible. And I think that's part of the success is by, you know, kind of being in the different platforms. So I've got the website, satelliteimagedeeplearning.com. That has links to all the other places where I have content as well. So I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter, I know a bit of a dirty word, but I'm on Twitter. There's even a group on Twitter as well. And of course, I use email too. So reach out on any of those channels.
Excellent. Well, it's been brilliant talking to you. Thanks very much for coming on the show.
It's been a pleasure.
It's been great. Cheers.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn, so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.